Chapter 58. Simple rules for saving money. To save half, when you are fired by an eager impulse to contribute to a charity, wait and count 40. To save 3/4, count 60. To save it all, count 65. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. The thug said, "How many of you English are passionately devoted to sporting? Your days and months are passed in its excitement. A tiger, a panther, a buffalo or a hog rouses your utmost energies for its destruction. You even risk your lives in its pursuit. How much higher game is a thug's? That must really be the secret of the rise and development of thuggy. The joy of killing, the joy of seeing killing done, these are traits of the human race at large. We white people are merely modified thugs, thugs fretting under the restraints of a not very thick skin of civilization, thugs who long ago enjoyed the slaughter of the Roman arena, and later the burning of doubtful Christians by authentic Christians in the public squares, and who now, with the thugs of Spain and Nimes, flock to enjoy the blood and misery of the bullring. We have no tourists of either sex, or any religion who are able to resist the delights of the bullring when opportunity offers, and we are gentle thugs in the hunting season, and love to chase a tame rabbit and kill it. Still, we have made some progress microscopic, and in truth scarcely worth mentioning, and certainly nothing to be proud of. Still, it is progress. We no longer take pleasure in slaughtering or burning helpless men. We have reached a little altitude, where we may look down upon the Indian thugs with a complacent shudder, and we may even hope for a day, many centuries hence, when our posterity will look down upon us in the same way. There are many indications that the thug often hunted men for the mere sport of it, that the fright and pain of the quarry were no more to him than are the fright and pain of the rabbit or the stag to us, and that he was no more ashamed of beguiling his game with deceits and abusing its trust than are we when we have imitated a wild animal's call, and shot it when it honored us with its confidence, and came to see what we wanted. Adara, son of Nil, and I, Ramzam, set out from Kati in the cold weather, and followed the high road for about 20 days in search of travelers, until we came to Selempur, where we met a very old man going to the east. We won his confidence in this manner. He carried a load which was too heavy for his old age. I said to him, "You are an old man, I will aid you in carrying your load, as you are from my part of the country." ... he said, "Very well, take me with you." ... so we took him with us to Selempur, where we slept that night. We woke him next morning before dawn and set out, and at the distance of 3 miles we seated him to rest, while it was still very dark. Madara was ready behind him, and strangled him. He never spoke a word. He was about 60 or 70 years of age. Another gang fell in with a couple of barbers, and persuaded them to come along in their company, by promising them the job of shaving the whole crew, 30 thugs. At the place appointed for the murder, 15 got shaved, and actually paid the barbers for their work. Then killed them, and took back the money. A gang of 42 thugs came across 2 Brahmins and a shopkeeper on the road, beguiled them into a grove, and got up a concert for their entertainment. While these poor fellows were listening to the music, the stranglers were standing behind them, and at the proper moment for dramatic effect they applied the noose. The most devoted fisherman must have a bite at least as often as once a week, or his passion will cool, and he will put up his tackle. The tiger-sportsman must find a tiger at least once a fortnight, or he will get tired and quit. The elephant hunter's enthusiasm will waste away little by little, and his zeal will perish at last, if he plod around a month without finding a member of that noble family to assassinate. But when the lust in the hunter's heart is for the noblest of all quarries, man, how different is the case! And how watery, and poor is the zeal, and how childish the endurance of those other hunters by comparison! Then, neither hunger, nor thirst, nor fatigue, nor deferred hope, nor monotonous disappointment, nor leaden-footed lapse of time can conquer the hunter's patience, or weaken the joy of his quest, or cool the splendid rage of his desire. Of all the hunting passions that burn in the breast of man, there is none that can lift him superior to discouragements like these, but the one, the royal sport, the supreme sport, whose quarry is his brother. By comparison, tiger hunting is a colorless poor thing, for all it has been so bragged about. Why, the thug was content to tramp patiently along, afoot, in the wasting heat of India, week after week, at an average of 9 or 10 miles a day, if he might, but hope to find game some time or other, and refresh his longing soul with blood. Here is an instance. Ramzam and Hyder set out, for the purpose of strangling travelers, from Gudapur, and proceeded via the fort of Jalalabad, Nualganj, Banjarmo, on the banks of the Ganges upwards of 100 miles, from whence we returned by another route. Still no travelers. Till we reached Boanaganj, where we fell in with a traveler, a boatman. We inveigled him, and about 2 miles east of there Hyder strangled him as he stood, for he was troubled and afraid, and would not sit. We then made a long journey about 130 miles, and reached his son Purbandwa, where at the tank we fell in with a traveler. He slept there that night. Next morning we followed him, and tried to win his confidence. At the distance of 2 miles we endeavored to induce him to sit down, but he would not, having become aware of us. I attempted to strangle him as he walked along, but did not succeed. Both of us then fell upon him. He made a great outcry, "They are murdering me!" At length we strangled him, and flung his body into a well. After this we returned to our homes, having been out a month and traveled about 260 miles. A total of 2 men murdered on the expedition. And here is another case related by the terrible Fuddy Khan, a man with a tremendous record, to be re-mentioned by and by. Kama with 3 others, traveled for about 45 days a distance of about 200 miles in search of victims along the highway to Bundwa, and returned by Davodpur another 200 miles, during which journey we had only 1 murder, which happened in this manner. 4 miles to the east of Nabustagat we fell in with a traveler, an old man. I, with Kaushal and Hyder, inveigled him and accompanied him that day within 3 miles of Rampur, where, after dark, in a lonely place, we got him to sit down and rest. And while I kept him in talk, seated before him, Hyder behind strangled him. He made no resistance. Kaushal stabbed him under the arms and in the throat, and we flung the body into a running stream. We got about 4 or 5 rupees each, $2 or $2. 5.50, we then proceeded homewards. A total of 1 man murdered on this expedition. There, they tramped 400 miles, were gone about 3 months, and harvested $2 and a half apiece. But the mere pleasure of the hunt was sufficient. That was pay enough. They did no grumbling. Every now and then in this big book one comes across that pathetic remark, "We tried to get him to sit down, but he would not." It tells the whole story. Some accident had awakened the suspicion in him, that these smooth friends who had been petting and coddling him, and making him feel so safe, and so fortunate after his forlorn and lonely wanderings were the dreaded thugs. And now their ghastly invitation to it and rest had confirmed its truth. He knew there was no help for him, and that he was looking his last upon earthly things, but he would not sit. No, not that it was too awful to think of. There are a number of instances which indicate that, when a man had once tasted the regal joys of man-hunting, he could not be content with the dull monotony of a crimeless life afterward. Example, from a thug's testimony. He passed through to Kurnaul, where we found a former thug named Junua, an old comrade of ours, who had turned religious mendicant, and become a disciple and holy. He came to us in the Sirai and weeping with joy returned to his old trade. Neither wealth nor honors nor dignities could satisfy a reformed thug for long. He would throw them all away, someday, and go back to the lurid pleasures of hunting men, and being hunted himself by the British. Ramzam was taken into a great native grandee's service, and given authority over 5 villages. Why authority extended over these people to summons them to my presence, to make them stand or sit? I dressed well, rode my pony, and had 2 sepoys, a scribe and a village guard to attend me. During 3 years I used to pay each village a monthly visit, and no one suspected that I was a thug. The chief man used to wait on me to transact business, and as I passed along, old and young made their salam to me. And yet during that very 3 years he got leave of absence to attend a wedding, and instead went off on a thugging lark with 6 other thugs, and hunted the highway for 15 days, with satisfactory results. Afterwards he held a great office under a Raja. There he had 10 miles of country under his command, and a military guard of 15 men, with authority to call out 2,000 more upon occasion. But the British got on his track, and they crowded him, so that he had to give himself up. See what a figure he was when he was gotten up for style, and had all his things on coal, and I was fully armed, a sword, shield, pistols, a matchlock musket and a flint gun, for I was fond of being thus arrayed, and when so armed feared, not though 40 men stood before me. He gave himself up and proudly proclaimed himself a thug. Then by request he agreed to betray his friend and pal, Burham, a thug with the most tremendous record in India. Went to the house, where Burham slept often as he led our gangs. I woke him, he knew me well, and came outside to me. It was a cold night, so under pretense of warming myself, but in reality to have light for his seizure by the guards, I lighted some straw, and made a blaze. We were warming our hands. The guards drew around us. I said to them, "This is Burham," apostrophe, and he was seized just as a cat seizes a mouse. Then Burham said, "I am a thug. My father was a thug. My grandfather was a thug, and I have thugged with many." Apostrophe, so spoke the mighty hunter, the mightiest of the mighty, the Gordon coming of his day. Not much regret noticeable in it. Aving planted a bullet in the shoulder bone of an elephant, and caused the agonized creature to lean for support against a tree, I proceeded to brew some coffee. Having refreshed myself, taking observations of the elephant's spasms and writhings between the sips, I resolved to make experiments on vulnerable points, and, approaching very near, I fired several bullets at different parts of his enormous skull. He only acknowledged the shots by a salam-like movement of his trunk, with the point of which he gently touched the wounds with a striking and peculiar action. Surprised and shocked to find that I was only prolonging the suffering of the noble beast, which bore its trials with such dignified composure, I resolved to finish the proceeding with all possible dispatch, and accordingly opened fire upon him from the left side. Aiming at the shoulder, I fired 6 shots with the 2-grooved rifle, which must have eventually proved mortal, after which I fired 6 shots at the same part with the Dutch 6-pounder. Large tears now trickled down from his eyes, which he slowly shut and opened. His colossal frame shivered convulsively, and falling on his side he expired. Gordon coming. So many times this official report leaves one's curiosity unsatisfied. For instance, here is a little paragraph out of the record of a certain band of 193 thugs, which has that defect. Ellen with Lal, Singh Sabadar and his family, consisting of 9 persons, traveled with them 2 days, and the 3rd put them all to death except the 2 children, little boys of 1.5 years old. There it stops. What did they do with those poor little fellows? What was their subsequent history? Did they purpose training them up as thugs? How could they take care of such little creatures on a march which stretched over several months? No one seems to have cared to ask any questions about the babies. But I do wish I knew. One would be apt to imagine that the thugs were utterly callous, utterly destitute of human feelings, heartless toward their own families as well as toward other peoples. But this was not so. Like all other Indians, they had a passionate love for their kin. A shrewd British officer who knew the Indian character took that characteristic into account in laying his plans for the capture of Eugene Sue's famous Feringhea. He found out Feringhea's hiding place, and sent a guard by night to seize him, but the squad was awkward, and he got away. However, they got the rest of the family, the mother, wife, child, and brother, and brought them to the officer at Jabalpur. The officer did not fret, but bided his time. I knew Feringhea would not go far while links so dear to him were in my hands. He was right. Feringhea knew all the danger he was running by staying in the neighborhood. Still, he could not tear himself away. The officer found that he divided his time between five villages where he had relatives and friends who could get news for him from his family in Jabalpur jail, and that he never slept two consecutive nights in the same village. The officer traced out his several haunts, then pounced upon all the five villages on the one night, and at the same hour, and got his man. Another example of family affection. A little while previously to the capture of Feringhea's family, the British officer had captured Feringhea's foster brother, leader of a gang of 10, and had tried the 11, and condemned them to be hanged. Feringhea's captured family arrived at the jail the day before the execution was to take place. The foster brother, Jerhu, entreated to be allowed to see the aged mother and the others. The prayer was granted, and this is what took place. It is the British officer who speaks. In the morning, just before going to the scaffold, the interview took place before me. He fell at the old woman's feet and begged that she would relieve him from the obligations of the milk with which she had nourished him from infancy, as he was about to die before he could fulfill any of them. She placed her hands on his head, and he knelt, and she said she forgave him all, and bid him die like a man. If a capable artist should make a picture of it, it would be full of dignity and solemnity and pathos, and it could touch you. You would imagine it to be anything but what it was. There is reverence there, and tenderness, and gratefulness, and compassion, and resignation, and fortitude, and self-respect, and no sense of disgrace, no thought of dishonor. Everything is there that goes to make a noble parting, and give it a moving grace and beauty and dignity. And yet one of these people is a thug and the other a mother of thugs. The incongruities of our human nature seem to reach their limit here. I wish to make note of one curious thing while I think of it. One of the very commonest remarks to be found in this bewildering array of thug confessions is this: strangled him and threw him in a well. In one case they threw 16 into a well, and they had thrown others in the same well before. It makes a body thirsty to read about it. And there is another very curious thing. The bands of thugs had private graveyards. They did not like to kill and bury at random, here and there and everywhere. They preferred to wait, and toll the victims along, and get to one of their regular burying places, Beals, if they could. In the little kingdom of Oud, which was about half as big as Ireland, and about as big as the state of Maine, they had 274 Beals. They were scattered along 1,400 miles of road, at an average of only 5 miles apart, and the British government traced out and located each and every one of them, and set them down on the map. The Oud band seldom went out of their own country, but they did a thriving business within its borders. So did outside bands who came in and helped. Some of the thug leaders of Oud were noted for their successful careers. Each of four of them confessed to above 300 murders, another to nearly 400. Our friend Ramzam to 604. He is the one who got leave of absence to attend a wedding, and went thugging instead, and he is also the one who betrayed Burham to the British. But the biggest records of all were the murder lists of Fuddy Khan and Burham. Fuddy Khan's number is smaller than Ramzam's, but he is placed at the head, Because his average is the best in out thug history per year of service. His slaughter was 508 men in 20 years, and he was still a young man when the British stopped his industry. Burham's list was 931 murders, but it took him 40 years. His average was one man and nearly all of another man per month for 40 years, but Fuddy Khan's average was two men and a little of another man per month during his 20 years. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.